From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar. And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. Missed you last week.
Don, pleasure. Missed you as well.
Okay, so let's start first with the, it's another form of Russia bashing, perhaps. I don't know, but there's word out on Facebook from a number of supporters of Syria that Russia is selling out Syria.
I can't help but laugh because I feel like that is a meme that seems to come around every couple of months, every time something changes in the situation and Russia's engaged in some kind of discussions with somebody, all of a sudden it's an immediate sellout. And quite frankly, I think that sort of analysis is not only unhelpful, but it's actually an indicator of a complete lack of understanding of the situation and a lack of understanding of politics and geopolitics and how the world actually works. Because quite frankly, I think that the news that's coming out now that's circulating in the media, let me summarize that for listeners. Basically, the story is right now, and it was based on an interview that a correspondent for BuzzFeed did, and now it's been sort of built on by other media outlets, has to do with so-called moderate opposition forces, presumably some element in the Free Syrian Army, whatever the hell that is, some of the non-Islamist, non-jihadist opposition are engaged in some kind of a negotiation process, or at least a dialogue with the Russians, that the Russians are basically coming in and trying to woo some of these elements onto their side, presumably for two reasons. One, to fight against the Islamists of Daesh and of the al-Nusra Front. I think that's obvious. And then two, to basically be part of some kind of a negotiated settlement after the Islamists are wiped out. And that's basically the premise of these negotiations, if you believe that they're happening. Now, I just want to say, first and foremost, there are a number of sources that are being used to allegedly verify this story. I can't speak to the validity or non-validity or invalidity of those sources. What I can say is that I have every reason to believe that such a negotiation is happening. It would make perfect sense for it to be happening. And quite frankly, it might actually be a constructive approach, considering how prolonged this conflict has become, considering the fact that as soon as Russia withdrew a significant portion of its forces, the Islamists immediately gained ground. The Islamists immediately began to push back against the Syrian Arab army and against some of the other forces on the ground there. So there is this lingering question of whether or not it would be possible for Russia to basically peel off some of the elements that had traditionally been backed by the CIA and or the Pentagon in some form or fashion by the US and its allies, peel them off and bring them into the Russian camp. And essentially, right, the idea is that the Russians would present themselves as, you know, not fair weather friends like the US, somebody who will provide you with the weapons, provide you with the funds, and not abandon you as soon as things get tough.
You know, see, that's the Syrian government has been doing this very same thing itself, basically offering amnesty to those that put down their arms, and they were doing that from the very beginning. And for the same reasons, the people that are no longer fighting the Syrian government are no longer fighting the Syrian government. And so it makes perfect sense from that perspective. Could we step back, though, give people an outline of the process that's going on, the UN process, the negotiations, and all of that, so they understand the context?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that there is all that much happening as far as the negotiation process. I mean, I know that we have representatives from these various sides. Remember that the Islamist camp is directly backed by Saudi Arabia. That we know. The so-called moderate camp has been, you know, they've been located in Turkey. They're engaged in this process to varying extents. But up until actually quite recently, the mantra had been that Assad had to go, that was a sort of a precondition. Well, now I think it's pretty clear to all parties involved that that's not happening. And so on the one hand, you could say that there is an opening for a more substantive dialogue process. On the other hand, we have seen an escalation in the level of violence inside of Syria, at least since the Russians pulled out. And I wonder whether that means that the opposition is really feeling forced to make a deal at this point. I don't see that they necessarily are. And again, I mean, the broader strategy here from the Western perspective is to get a negotiated settlement that de facto carves up the country, right? That is part of the, I think, policy now from the United States, is what I've been talking about. I mean, on this show, on my show, writing about it, talking about it. I mean, God, how long, Don? At least 3 years.
Yeah, right.
Right. We've been talking about it, certainly since the Brookings Institution published the Deconstructing Syria paper. Right. And right. This is something that we've known for a long time. I think John Kerry called it his Plan B? You know, I mean, there's been a number of different brandings for this same policy direction, from the neocons like John Bolton, who wrote about it in the New York Times, to John Kerry's talked about it, the Brookings, and a bunch of others. So I think that that is still very much on the table. And I think that from the U.S. perspective, that's what negotiations are about. They're about creating the conditions for a de facto, not necessarily an outright partitioning of Syria, but a de facto partitioning of Syria. When they talk about things like decentralizing the government, giving more authority to the regions and so forth, which in effect could be a good thing in one sense, but in another sense it could be quite disastrous, because it would of course be a way of exacerbating the sectarian tensions, ethnic tensions, religious and so forth. And I think that you should be wary of that process. So the UN is kind of the backdrop for all of this. We've seen the ceasefire collapse. We've seen actually how many now? Two or three different ceasefires that have collapsed. We don't see too much progress as far as the negotiations, so it's really more of a talking shop than anything.
Yeah, and I mean, the wrangling is still going on. We saw what happened in the past few days at the UN, that revelations by the Secretary General that the making of lists of terrorist groups that people are not allowed to play with and that are supposed, you know, that are legitimate targets, that list was manipulated by the Saudis, and also that the Saudis have been playing with their own designation as bad actors in Yemen.
Well, if the Saudis are trying to present themselves as not terrorists, I suppose, and not terrorist supporters, I suppose one could understand why they would do that, although I think it's as obvious as the nose on your face what the Saudis are doing, and that, well, quite frankly, that what the Saudis are doing in Yemen is, well, more or less an extended and ongoing war crime.
Right.
I think that the people who are actually responsible for the war in Yemen should certainly find themselves in the dock at The Hague.
For sure.
There's no doubt that every time they bomb in Yemen, they are committing war crimes. I think that that is pretty much understood from the bombing of civilian infrastructure and hospitals and roads and schools and all of the rest of that, too. Just the indiscriminate form of attacks that they've been waging, to essentially carrying out a long-term siege, which is also in effect a war crime. Interesting how the Assad government in Syria was endlessly portrayed as committing war crimes for siege warfare,
right.
But when Saudi Arabia holds an entire country under siege, there's very little discussion about it. But yeah. I digress.
Yeah, I mean, looking at Raqqa, for example, you know, they're taking that accusation right now as they try to retake Raqqa. But the U.S. is lining up a similar siege of Fallujah, which it had done before and leveled and murdered people with phosphorus weapons and everything else. But all I can think of is Israel and Gaza.
Well, Israel and Gaza is the must be the longest running siege in history, right?
Yes, this longer than
this is many years now. And I mean, even if even if you wanted to start with the point at which the Israeli settlers withdrew from Gaza, I mean, what was that, 2005?
Yeah, 2006, something like
six.
That.
Six. Yeah. Okay, so it's been a decade-long siege of Gaza. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely.
That's longer than Leningrad.
Yeah, and absolutely, and in some ways more vicious, because at least in Leningrad it was mostly about starvation.
Yeah, and they didn't have American fighter jets back
in Gaza. It's an annual massacre that the Israelis carry out.
That's right.
So in any event, the Syrian opposition, I think that this is an interesting point, though, because, look, let's leave aside the people who endlessly drone about Russia selling out Syria. That sort of analysis is really, not only is it, I think, incorrect, but it's also, I think, quite superficial. I don't think that politics and geopolitics of at this level really operates in that way. Right. What I think it's about is about interests, and it's about whose interests are best served by this kind of strategy. And I think that it's pretty clear, in my view, that Russia is pursuing what amounts to the absolute correct course, diplomatically speaking and politically speaking, because what they're essentially offering is a potential solution to the crisis in Syria. Because, look, even the moderate opposition, the so-called non-Islamist, non-jihadist, not ISIS, not al-Nusra, not Ahrar al-Sham, not Jaish al-Islam, none of these groups, but the so-called Free Syrian Army groups, the various militias and other elements that are, some of them are still inside the country, most of them have probably fled already. These groups, in my estimation, do represent a path forward for Russia and for Syria, because what it amounts to is the creation of a coalition, an anti-terror coalition that the Russians will cobble together, the Russians will back without having to use their own military power, which is politically unpalatable for a number of reasons, and they'll be able to create a situation where they can then walk into a negotiated settlement process where the two sides that are negotiating are both in the pockets of Moscow. That's the key here, right? And not to say in the pockets in the most insidious way. I mean, in the pockets, meaning that Russia will have considerable influence right. to force a solution.
Right.
To say, look, we backed both of you, and both of you need to come to some kind of an agreement here. And I think that Russia will be in a very strong position to do that if they are successful in peeling off some of these moderate opposition elements. And I hate to use the term moderate opposition, but I don't know what other term to use. That's the term that's been used. That's the term people are using. So that's what I'm saying. But in any event, these groups that are not associated with the Islamist elements, they, I think, are ripe for the picking. And so the question is, how many of them are going to trust Russia? I think a significant portion of them will not trust Russia. However, and this is, I think, where Russia really has a significant amount of influence here, those who choose to take Russia's offer, those who choose to be financially and militarily supported by Moscow, they're going to be the ones who are going to be included in a settlement and a negotiation process. They're going to be the ones who are going to end up with a piece of political power in a post-war Syria. And those who turn down the offer, they're going to be left sitting in Turkey or in Houston, Texas, or wherever the hell they end up. Right. But they're not going to have power in Syria. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you look at the jockeying that's taking place, first of all, you have the U.S. with the so-called moderate rebels, okay, so they're pushing to have them at the table, and whoever is left, if they can hire five or six guys to be that, they'll be at the table. You've got the Syrian government has already done this on an ongoing basis. Drop your arms and just stop fighting, and you have amnesty, and we will consider your demands as part of a peaceful body politic of Syria when we sit down and hash all this out. And now Russia's saying, we have some of those players in there, too, at the end of the day. In the meantime, these people are no longer shooting at Syrians and or shooting at Russian planes.
That's true. However, I will say, to be fair, I'm not sure that the Assad government let's put it this way. I'm not sure that the Assad government is an actor that any of those oppositions are willing to trust. You know, I mean, considering everything that's happened, considering the length of this war and everything that led up to the war, I'm not sure that these opposition forces are looking at Assad and saying, oh, sure, yeah, let's deal. Let's throw down our weapons.
No,
let's take amnesty and let's deal.
Some have.
Some have,
and
right.
Like
some,
I'm saying, and what happens is when you have a phalanx of so-called moderate opponents, this group is saying, yes, we're willing to negotiate with the government on that point, like Assad must go or whatever it is. Another group's going to say, no, we won't negotiate with them at all. He's got to go. Another group will be saying, well, we'll negotiate with this and not with that, et cetera. I mean, you start, you know, having more or less discrete groupings of moderate rebels. Yeah,
I understand that. But I will say, though, that I think that the groups that were willing to take that offer from Assad have already done so, and they're already out of the picture.
Yeah,
you know, they've dropped out of the war. They've gone home. They've done whatever they've done, and they're not in the picture anymore. The groups that still have their arms, that still in various ways are in opposition to Assad and actively engaged in this conflict, whether on the battlefield or from Turkey or whatever, I'm not sure that they would be willing to take any kind of offer from Assad, but
right.
I do think they'd be willing to listen to offers from Putin.
Right.
And that's really what this comes down to,
right.
Is I don't think that any of these opposition forces are in love with Assad. I don't think that any of them want want to just settle this between them. I think that they want political power. That's what they want. They want
right.
a piece of the government.
Right.
And the only way they're going to get that is through Russia at this point. And I think that that's where this whole Russia is selling out Assad comes in. The notion that Russia would be working towards a situation of negotiation is, in effect, a sellout of Assad from the perspective of these what I would call Syria fetishists, right? People for whom Syria is the only issue that exists in the world. Well, I'm sorry, but it isn't. And for Russia, they're taking a much bigger picture of this issue. And it's absolutely, it's what you and I have talked about before, what we were talking about before we started recording, that it's not only about Syria, it is about what Russia can offer to countries that are targeted by imperialism, that are targeted by the United States. Russia certainly, on the one hand, doesn't want to look like it's offering a sellout, but at the same time, it is offering a way to, maintain the government, prevent a Libya-style scenario, and objectively achieve some level of peace.
Right.
Right? That's pretty attractive as far as I'm concerned. If I'm
sure.
If I'm the leader of a country and I look at what happened to Iraq and I look at what happened to Libya and I look at what happened to a number of countries that the U.S. targeted.
If you're an everyday Syrian even, you don't have to be a leader.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I'm saying, is that I think that what the Russians are offering sounds pretty good from an objective perspective. And I think that you have to get past this sort of hyper emotional knee-jerk reaction that a lot of people have to this issue and look at it objectively and say, well, let's see, what are the Russians offering? They're offering to essentially back forces that will not fight the Syrian Arab Army, but will fight Daesh and the al-Nusra Front. And then those forces will be brought to the negotiating table under the auspices of a Russian-brokered agreement. Well, you see that I didn't mention the United States and NATO and
right.
France and the
right.
and the British there. That is already very attractive for some people around the world, for people inside of Syria as well.
Right. I mean, you end up having if you have two sides, on one side, the government, Russia, and whatever groups are peeled off. And then on the other side, you have essentially all of the terrorist groups and the opposition groups that are sponsored by the U.S. and the U.S.
Yeah. Right. And again, I mean, this is not even necessarily to be, pro-Russia or pro-Syria or anti-Syria or anti-Russia. This is the objective reality.
Right.
Five plus years of war in Syria, a devastated country, a population that undoubtedly, no matter what kind of political fervor they may or may not have, are tired, are weakened,
right.
are, desperate for an end to the war. Morale, who knows exactly where that stands. And I think that there is a significant portion, if not a majority, of Syrians who would welcome with open arms any kind of a settlement, even if it includes making peace with some elements that had taken up arms against the government and the state.
Yep, I agree with that. All right, so.
Well, I just want to add a couple of other points here, though, because I think that these are important as well. Let's not forget that in the midst of all of this, there continues to be this, I guess you could call it, jockeying for strategic position when it comes to these air bases, when it comes to some of the military infrastructure. Obviously, Russia sees Syria as critical to its own military posture, with its foothold in the Mediterranean, with its centrality to the Middle East and so forth. So from the Russian strategic perspective, Syria is very, very important. From the Russian political and diplomatic perspective, it's obviously very important. And again, as I guess as I already mentioned, I just want to reiterate, if Russia is able to be the guarantor and broker of a real peace agreement in Syria, that would be, I hate to use the phrase, but I hate the phrase, a game changer.
Yep, I agree. Definitely. Definitely. On a large stage, by the way, on a global stage in a way. I mean, it's a question of where else would Russia actually do this, but it certainly fertilizes the soil just about everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I think that the real question that I have is, what's the U.S. going to do here? Because I don't think that anybody should be falsely comfortable in believing that the U.S. is just going to sit back and let all of this happen. I don't think that that's the case. And I think that the U.S. certainly has its designs on Syria still, as I mentioned, and they're undoubtedly providing some kind of a counter strategy to what the Russians are doing. Now,
let me ask you, you think, for example, German tanks rolling through Poland towards Russia this past week are part of that response?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Although I don't know whether it's as much about Syria or about Ukraine or just about in general muscle flexing,
right,
with the new
all of the above, yeah.
the new what's it called? The new Supreme Commander of NATO and all of the rest of that. I don't know. But I will say this, that I think that it is it's really critical to watch how the U.S. responds. And I wonder, is there a calculation, and I have no idea if this is true or not, is there a calculation on the part of the Russians that right now they have a window to act in Syria that they will not have when Hillary Clinton assumes the presidency? I think that there is definitely that calculation taking place in Russia right now, because I do think that they see a significant difference between Clinton and Trump. I think that they do, as the sort of the pro-Trump position becomes increasingly apparent from, you know, certain elements and international media and so forth who don't want to see a Hillary Clinton presidency. Right. Now, I don't know whether this is actually factoring into their decision making or not, but it would certainly make sense, because I'll tell you right now, if this conflict remains the same when Hillary Clinton comes into power, you can bet on one thing: increased bloodshed.
Yep. Yeah, there'll be an air campaign, you know, no fly zone, blah blah blah. You'll see Libya again. I'm wondering, let me ask you something before you go there. Do you think that if Trump climbs in the polls or drops in the polls as against Clinton, that you're going to see shifts in the Russian negotiating strategy at the table?
Probably not. Not significant shifts in what they in their strategy. Well, no, let me back up from that. The shift could happen only insofar as the time scale, I think. If they really feel that a Trump presidency is really going to happen, and it's insane that we're even saying it, but it seems it's possible. I mean, it really is possible now. Then I think that they may play for time. They may feel, rightly or wrongly, I can't say, but they may feel that they have a better shot at negotiating something with a Trump presidency. Right. That Trump is so narcissistic and egomaniacal that he would come into office and immediately try to settle the Syria issue once and for all and negotiate a way out of there. Now, there might be Russians in the Russian government who really think that. I'm personally skeptical that that's really the case. If I look at Trump's foreign policy advisors, people like Walid Fares, who want to increase the war in Syria, who are pro-Israel, who, you know, anti-Iran and so forth.
And
so
then there's just the general question of, do you believe anything that comes out of the mouth of a politician in the United States, particularly when you have no record to measure?
Yeah, I don't see any reason to believe anything that Trump says, nor do I have any reason to believe anything Clinton says, right, other than when she promises war.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. And I'm obviously about as cynical gets when it comes to U.S. electoral campaigns. But I bring it up because I do think that there is a real question as to whether the Russians would alter their strategy vis-a-vis Clinton or Trump. I think it's possible.
Right. Okay, so you were going to go somewhere else before I interrupted you.
I don't remember now. Go ahead.
Good. So then Magnitsky and the whole thing with first the original affair and the Magnitsky Act, and now Browder's trying to shut down a film that talks about $230 million in being lifted from the Russian treasury, in essence, benefiting Browder. You want to chat? I guess give people some background on the whole Magnitsky case.
Sure. Well, part of the reason why we're talking about this now, I had a piece come out this past week. What did I title it? U.S. bullying Canada to pursue anti-Russian foreign policy or something like that. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
It was up on Counterpunch this past weekend. But look, the background of this, I think, is important. Magnitsky, this whistleblower who mysteriously dies in Russia in the custody of the authorities there. Supposedly, he was going to blow the whistle on massive corruption and embezzlement and all kinds of things. Magnitsky was backed by this billionaire named Bill Browder, who... interestingly, I think he's the grandson of Earl Browder of the Communist Party in the U.S. Seriously, I'm pretty sure he is.
And he's a millionaire, yep.
Yeah, I think he's a billionaire, in fact.
Oh, he's a UK millionaire of U.S. origin, yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I think he's in the U.K. I think he's based in the U.K.
Yeah.
Anyway, which would make sense, City of London, right? Right. Anyway, so Browder is basically this vulture capitalist, right? He comes to Russia in the 90s to make tons of money, as all the vulture capitalists did. But unlike a lot of them, he was actually remaining in Russia into Putin's administration, actually up until about 2005, 2006, that period. So he remained a lot longer than many of the others, and he was seen as really the voice of finance capital of the pro-Putin camp. He was very pro-Putin. He was lauding Putin as a savior of Russia, as, you know, the greatest thing to happen, as somebody who was really dedicated to protecting investor rights and so forth, which is actually quite true, particularly in Putin's early years in office. And actually, Browder had come out in support of Putin arresting Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the other oligarch who had been arrested for various illegal activities in relation to the Yukos oil company, which he was the owner of. So anyway, Browder was this pro-Putin finance capital investor guy up until he was ceremonially or unceremoniously shown the door out of Russia by the Russian government for reasons that I think probably remain somewhat cloudy, although I could venture a few guesses. Ever since then, he has been on this crusade against Putin. Really, he's become probably the leading voice of anti-Putin activism anywhere in the world, I would say. And one of the things that he has done is he has pushed through this thing called the Magnitsky Act, which is named for this whistleblower who I mentioned. Browder has basically spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying in the United States and elsewhere to push through what is now known as the Magnitsky Act, which basically puts sanctions, financial sanctions, on key members of the Russian government, particularly individuals who Browder claims were associated with the Magnitsky assassination, as he calls it. So anyway, the reason we bring this up is because this act was passed in 2012 in the United States, and Browder has been on a campaign to make sure that every other country in NATO in the West passes some version of the Magnitsky Act. And that's actually what's happening right now, because in Canada, they're desperately pushing the Canadian government to adopt something on the order of the Magnitsky Act. It wouldn't necessarily be called the same thing, but something along those lines. And the Canadian government, specifically the foreign affairs minister, has publicly come out saying that they don't want to do that. And it's obvious the reasons why. Canada has vested interests in maintaining some kind of cordial relations with the Russian government. They're both oil, they're both oil-based economies, oil exporters. They both have certain interests. Canada, of course, is deeply connected to NATO, but they don't want to necessarily take 100% of the diktats from Washington either.
Agricultural exports too. I mean, they're a big agricultural exporter.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of reasons why Canada wants to maintain some kind of relations with Russia. And what's come out in the course of all of this is the well, let me back up. This came out publicly again as an issue in the United States and in Canada just a few days ago, because former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who of, you know, he of infamous, you know, blundering fame as the ambassador in Russia, Mr. Soft Power, Mr. Color Revolution, Michael McFaul, he cried foul, get it, on Canada.
That was foul.
Thank you. I know. I wrote it down on a 3x5 card and I was just waiting to pull it out here. Anyway, he was public in an interview with the Canadian press, publicly chastising the Canadian government and questioning, I think, pretty insulting as far as I'm concerned and undiplomatic, questioning Canada's commitment to human rights. Is Canada actually committed to human rights? Wow. If you are, then pass this bill. Basically what McFaul said.
So meanwhile, you have, let's say, in Honduras, a coup government that has
killing. You're really preempting my next comment.
Because what about sanctioning Honduras, for example?
What about sanctioning Saudi Arabia rather than selling them tens of billions of dollars of weapons?
Right. I mean, cutting off heads, I guess, is a lot more extreme than what
Magnitsky and bombing babies in Yemen and all of the rest of that. That's precisely what I was writing.
So,
I mean, the idea that the U.S., and again, McFaul is speaking for the U.S. He's about as the establishment gets. McFaul is, in many ways, the leading anti-Putin voice in the United States. And for him to make such a statement, particularly calling out by name specifically calling out the foreign affairs minister, a very high-ranking person in the Canadian government, I think it shows the level of contempt that the United States has for even its own allies. I mean, is there any ally closer to the U.S. than Canada? I mean, I guess the U.K. and Israel, if you want to really, you know, split hairs about it. But Canada is about as in the U.S. camp as it gets. And even still, it's getting abused publicly by the U.S. over this issue. Now, why is this so important? I think that there are a number of reasons why. I think one of them is Browder is very wealthy, and this is a personal vendetta that he has against Putin. I think there's no doubt about that. And interestingly, Browder is behind a number of anti-Putin voices, including formerly well-respected authors and writers who are now vehemently anti-Putin in the West, including members of the Duma who are anti-Putin, specifically, what's his name, Ponomarev, I believe, and then one of the authors, similar name, I want to say Ponomartsev or something like that, I forget. But anyway, Browder is bankrolling a lot of this anti-Putin propaganda, and the reason is because A, a personal vendetta, but also B, because this is one of the ways that they hope to undermine Putin's credibility among, let's say, respectable circles of Western finance and Western business. Right. This is the key here, right? The danger for the United States and for NATO is that their sanctions, although they have hurt Russia, I think there's no doubt about that. If you ask ordinary Russians, they're hurting, and the sanctions are certainly a part of that. The collapse of oil prices is a part of that and other issues. But It is to focus the energy of the West against the business interests that want to continue doing business with Russia. I think that's what this is about. Russia's strategy has continued to be to try to divide the political leadership in Europe from the business leadership in Europe. You see that with the construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany, forcing German business interests into a confrontation with Germany's political leadership, with Merkel and her party specifically, forcing the business community to take sides when it comes to things like Gazprom making a hundreds billions of dollars deal with Royal Dutch Shell, one of the biggest companies in the world, one of the biggest oil companies based in Europe. So there's a lot of these sort of international business machinations that are happening that I think are really the target of these kinds of sanctions and that are the target of things like the Magnitsky Act.
Yep. And now you have some pushback. There's this film that I mentioned. Actually, it's supposed to be tomorrow, Monday, at the Newseum in D.C., showing a documentary that's called The Magnitsky Act. It focuses on Magnitsky. He was a tax and legal consultant for Browder's Hermitage Capital Management. And it basically shows that Browder was involved in theft of some $230 million of Russian taxpayers' money as a result of tax evasion. That's according to Sputnik this morning.
Oh, yeah. And that is, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, I mean, these vulture capitalists who were in Russia, I mean, they were doing much more than tax evasion. I mean, these privatization schemes that were ongoing all throughout the 90s that Yeltsin's administration oversaw as these Wall Street types and City of London types came in and really just, I mean, made hand over fist billions and billions of dollars on those sort of privatization schemes. It's the creation of the oligarch system.
Right.
I mean,
that's
this
right.
is something that's well known and well documented. Browder was right in the middle of all of that. Browder was making his millions just like everybody else was off the back of Russian working people. And I think that the evasion of taxes is part of that. I think that it also has to do with access. This is really, I think, one of the major things. Once Browder was cut out by Putin and his circle,
right.
That's when Browder really became this crusader, right? And I think that this is in many ways something that is deeply personal to him, and it's not necessarily only political. Browder strikes me, if I could be perfectly blunt about it, Browder strikes me as somebody who doesn't care that much about the politics. He cares about his own image, his
right.
own personal, you know, self. What am I looking for? Self-image, self-worth, self-confidence. I think that he feels personally slighted by Putin, and that's what this is about.
Too. I mean, when he loses influence with the Russian government, there are deals that he can't do that he was accustomed to doing before, and that's one of the reasons he was bringing in people like Magnitsky in the first place, was to be doing business over there. Now he's cut out.
Yeah, exactly right. So anyway, I think that that's really what's at the root here. But the larger political implication, I think, is interesting because, look, Canada has been – oh, I just remembered what I wanted to mention. Sorry.
Go ahead.
The other thing that I wanted to say was that the foreign minister of Canada said quite publicly – he pointed to Canada's inclusion in the Syria Contact Group – that is sponsored by the U.S. and Russia, specifically because Russia asked for them to be part of that group based on their relations. And so the foreign minister is basically saying, why would I push for the passage of this unnecessary bill that we already have legal means to go after these people? Why would I push for this, stick my thumb in the eye of the Russians right after they just invited Canada to be one of the main participants in the Syria Contact Group at the UN?
Right.
I mean,
that's a good question.
It's a great point that he makes, and it obviously makes McFaul look like an idiot and the U.S. look very foolish, because what they're essentially demonstrating is that there is no such thing as an ally of the U.S. You are a client of the U.S. and no more.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what else do you want to talk about?
Well, I think that it's important to bring this up, and I think it's important to bring it up in the context of You know, I don't want to get too deep into it, but in the context of the election, I think that this matters. I think that Russia really figures centrally in this, and I hear a lot of talk about people saying how Trump is really, you know, Trump is a nationalist and an isolationist, and Trump is going to improve our relations with Moscow and so forth. I mean, whether or not the Russians believe that, I certainly don't believe that. I look at Trump and I base my understanding of Trump on who is advising him, who is in his team, who he's listening to. And quite frankly, Trump is listening to Wall Street. Trump is listening to the same interests that all the rest of them listen to. I mean, his finance advisor is George Soros's business partner, for God's sake. Right. You know, his finance advisor is formerly of Goldman Sachs, right, close to George Soros, working on Wall Street, hedge fund manager. I mean, who do you think, what kind of policies do you think Trump is going to put in place? I mean, do you think that Trump is going to totally change the game when it comes to U.S. imperialism? Obviously not. No. I think the Russians feel that Trump offers them personally, you know, as a country, offers them a better chance at shoring up their own political position in Eastern Europe through a non-interventionist strategy. I think that's somewhat debatable, but if that's what they believe, then that's what they believe. Ultimately, I do think that this election has sort of shaped up to be basically a bad or worse scenario, and it's a matter of political perspective, which you think is bad and which you think is worse.
Well, let me ask you a couple things, because these are two things that I've discussed with Professor Montero and Margaret Kimberly and some others.
Two good friends of mine.
Yeah. And of ours. So one has to do with the possibility. I mean, Trump is clearly institutionally an insurgent, whatever else he is.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
And he's reconfigured the Republican Party in a way the Democrats have been saying they were trying to for decades, you know, with one fell swoop, basically. You have millions of Republican voters who aren't voting on abortion or gay marriage or whatever anymore. They're voting on economics. And yeah. And I'm wondering if both the foreign policy questions that he raised, having to do with NATO, having to do with you know, paying to keep the military in Japan and Korea and all of that, at least trying to get some of that reimbursed to a point of parity, to a point of equity, that if this doesn't represent some break in the elite over some of these questions, and particularly this one, remembering where Trump comes from, he comes out of the real estate industry, okay, and the construction industry. And so you have all these people that have been sitting on their hands for a very long time and have seen their power eroded by the outright, just the literal financial sector, and the military-industrial complex getting all of the money out of the federal government. I'm wondering if they're, when he's talking about let's put people back to work, let's build infrastructure, et cetera, if he's not talking about taking some of the money being spent on the military and applying it to, you know, basically giving it to construction companies to rebuild the stuff, and they would be hiring workers. If this isn't maybe a break in the elite where his sector, I guess that would be real estate, gambling, and the mafia, whatever, looking to get contracts to build bridges and housing and stuff like that.
Well, you're not the first person to bring it up. I think that there is some merit to thinking about it in that way, but I would pose it slightly differently. What you're essentially saying is that Trump is anti-neoliberal. Because ultimately that is what you're describing. What you're describing is a Keynesian form of non-neoliberal economics.
Right.
And I think that it is certainly very attractive in election season. I think it's certainly very attractive to speak that way when your base is working class, middle class, poor working class and middle class white workers, certainly. But let's just pause for a moment. Is that fundamentally different than what Obama said in 2008? I would argue no. Obama said the same exact thing.
Yep. And again, you have, in addition to that, you have this is just the word of a politician running for office, so who knows for real. But I'm wondering both if you have maybe motivated some part of the elite that's been cut out of the decision-making process, exerting itself through Trump's candidacy. And then another thing, since he talks about let's make the European countries pay the 2% of their GDP for NATO, or do we really need NATO to be what it is and reduce the cost, that would, of course, and likewise in Japan and South Korea, that would, of course, increase the portion of the budget of the of those countries that would be applied to the military, and that means more austerity. You have already pretty powerful peace movements in a lot of Western European countries. I'm wondering if that wouldn't provoke an even larger response against NATO.
It definitely would. It definitely would, but that's part of the reason why I'm saying that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I hear you.
I don't see that happening. I don't. First of all, I don't think that the president has that kind of power. I mean, not in a
not
real
alone,
sense.
For sure, yeah. For
you
sure.
know, in an abstract sense, I suppose that he does, but in a very practical sense, not really. NATO is, it's the military power projection of the United States in Europe, and it has been for decades. It's much bigger than any administration. It's not something that can necessarily be, you know, dismantled or even necessarily rolled back that easily. However, obviously, looking at Trump versus Clinton, I mean, it's quite obvious which of them is more pro-NATO, more pro-military, more pro-war. There's no doubt about that. Unfortunately, Trump is also playing with very dangerous forces inside of the U.S., and that's what makes Trump quite dangerous in a somewhat different way than Clinton. But what I do think, and let me back up. I want to get back to your original question because it's a good one, and I don't know that anybody really discusses it. Does Trump represent a different segment of the ruling class than Clinton and her predecessors? In some
and
ways,
and the Republican elite. I mean,
and the Republican right, elite. Right, right. Well, okay. Let me take the Republican elite first. There's no doubt that he represents different interests than the Republican elite in some ways, right? This is part of the reason why the Koch brothers wanted to freeze Trump out of the Republican, basically the mechanics of the Republican machine that they operate, including, you know, voter registration data and polling data and all right. of those other things that phone bank information and stuff, all of those things that any major campaign needs. The Koch brothers tried to freeze the Trump campaign out of that. That alone indicated just how much the Kochs were afraid of Trump, you know, really taking over their party, to the point now where the Kochs are basically backing Clinton, although they won't, you know, openly say it in a proud, loud and proud kind of way. They are basically backing Clinton. So
and that's
yes,
why
I
you're seeing Gary Johnson in the media a lot, too. The libertarians are getting a hell of a lot of media play, and you can bet that they're behind that, too.
Yeah, but also the only reason why is because Gary Johnson is who is the guy that he had? Bill Weld was his running mate. I mean, these are basically reconstructed neocons.
Right.
You know what
That's
I mean?
Right.
They're pro-war. You know, unlike a libertarian of the Ron Paul school, right? They're not true isolationists. They're pro-war, and well, like all libertarians, they're pro-business.
Right. Right.
So, you know, you're pro-war and pro-business, the Kochs can get behind that.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And I think it was Bill Weld or Gary Johnson. One of them historically had said that they wouldn't think twice about bombing Iran.
Right.
Right? I mean, that is like a pure neocon position.
And moronic.
Right?
I mean, you at least think twice before you did it for Christmas sake. Okay.
yeah. So anyway, you know, I think that they are behind that. That's for sure. And they're trying to, you know, do whatever they can to kind of steal a few votes away from Trump here and there, maybe swing a state or two, you know, by doing that, certainly. And that's part of the reason why the Libertarian Party is getting more traction than the Green Party. Libertarian Party seems to have some kind of institutional backing. Now, anyway, what I want to say, though, in answer to your question, and I think, I said, I think it's important. Trump represents some elements that are outside of the traditional dominant faction of the ruling class. However, he also represents the interests of the dominant faction of the ruling class. That's what I'm saying. That's why the hypothesis, or, you know, the thesis that Trump is a threat to the ruling establishment, I don't buy.
Right.
I think Trump is makes some of them uneasy. That's for sure. I think that Trump is a bit more unpredictable. That's for sure. He's not a 100% puppet like, you know, Obama or Clinton or Bush, right? But at the end of the day, Trump has the same interests that they have. That's why it's Waleed Farez and what's his name? Munchen from the Soros partner who's working as his finance advisor. That's why you have members of the big oil companies and Bush administration neocons and torturers and others who are all on Trump's campaign team. It's not because Trump, you know, desperately wants them there. It's because Trump has to have the ruling class within his inner circle. He has to, and he knows he does.
Yep, of course. I mean, you know, all that negotiating, quote unquote, that went on and is clearly ongoing, looking at Romney yesterday, inside the Republican Party between Trump's camp and the party elite, whatever, the and the interests behind those people that were formerly in control of the party. That's exactly what all of those negotiations are about.
Sure. Of course. And that's what's happening. And so that's why, again, I mean, you know, I hear a lot from people who are, you know, on the right in the U.S. or even internationally, who talk about how Trump is so great and Trump is going to change things and Trump is going to not, you know, is going to not start wars and all of the rest of that. I see no evidence to back any of that up. All I see are the things that Trump has said, and Trump says a lot of contradictory things. Trump says whatever he thinks people want to hear. Trump is a master manipulator of public opinion. That's what he does. He's a marketer. He's a brand name. I mean, let's not forget, Trump hasn't really built buildings in a long time.
That's right. That's
Trump,
right.
Trump his name. Rents license out his name,
right.
His you know,
yep.
So somebody who is able to make billions of dollars trading on just their name as a trademark is somebody who doesn't really, in my view, have the kind of convictions that a lot of people seem to be projecting onto him.
Yeah, because that's exactly what they're doing, is projecting it.
But that's what happens every time we have an effing election, Don. I remember in 2008, all of these liberal ass a-holes, sorry, you're gonna have to bleep that out. all of these liberal people were saying Obama's gonna give us peace, Obama's gonna end the war, Obama's gonna finally bring an end to these illegal and unjust wars.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
They still
because
have the
Obama's
bumper sticker
on the stage saying he's gonna increase the war in Afghanistan,
that's right.
He's gonna drone bomb Pakistan,
that's
he's
right.
gonna kill innocent people, and he promised to do it without consulting the American people.
Yep.
And he said it on stage.
In 2012, after he had been doing that for 4 years, there were people driving around with bumper stickers with a peace sign in the O for Obama.
Yeah, no, I know. And it's pure projection. It's the I forget whose concept it is. It's the empty vessel, right? The empty vessel. The Obama was an empty vessel into which you could pour your hopes and dreams, right? And in many ways, that's kind of what Trump is for the hard right in the United States. And not just the hard right, even a lot of the center right. I give you one example. I know we're running out of time. I just want to make it very clear that I understand to a large extent this movement around Trump, okay? I know somebody who is in his early 60s who is just a basic, you know, conservative guy, very smart, very sharp, well, you know, well educated, well to, you know, affluent, I suppose, middle class, upper middle class, right? Good paying job, easing his way into retirement. This person who has voted for Republicans for basically his whole life is very supportive of Trump. Why? Because he's embarrassed of the Republicans that he's voted for up until now. That's why.
Yeah.
Because he knows in his heart that Iraq was a disaster. He knows in his heart that the Bushes are a joke. He knows in his heart that the time of Reagan is long since past. And he desperately, desperately wants something, anything different. And that's what Trump is, and that's what he has seized on. So he seized on the white supremacist vote. He seized, you know, the racist vote. He seized on the economically downtrodden white poor and white working class vote. And he's seizing on the middle class white dejected Republican vote.
Right.
That is pretty powerful.
Yep. I mean, if you push the evangelicals out of there, that's actually a fairly typical. And you're substituting instead those who were disaffected by all the previous Republican administrations. That's a pretty typical Republican coalition.
Yeah, it's a huge voting bloc.
That's right.
And I've said this before. I'm willing to bet that because of the way this whole Bernie Sanders thing has sort of ended in the very predictable way that it has, willing to bet that only, you know, I'm willing to bet that a significant portion of them are never going to vote for Clinton.
That's
okay.
Right. That's
now, right. I don't know whether that's 25%, 30%, 40%. Who knows, right? No way to say. But let's assume that somewhere between a quarter and a third of Sanders voters are not going to vote for Clinton. They're not going to support Clinton. Okay. I think the majority of them stay home. Or some of them maybe throw some votes to Jill Stein and the Green Party or whatever.
Right.
But I'm willing to bet you that a pretty large number of them might actually vote for Trump. And I don't think they would ever admit it publicly. They certainly won't admit that in a poll. But Trump is, in many ways, the anti-establishment candidate that has at least some elements of what Sanders people want and what Sanders represents. Think about it.
That's right.
Trump will run to the left of Hillary on war.
Yep.
Trump will run to the left of Hillary on Social Security.
Yep.
Trump will run to the left of Hillary on
trade.
On a number of issues, including trade.
Yep.
So if you think about it, Trump has a better chance of stealing off some of Bernie's supporters than Hillary does on those
right.
key issues. And that's why he's made so many appeals to the Sanders voters. And I think that that is not something that should be ignored, because if you think about it, a couple of states, just a couple of states that Trump could take away from the Democratic camp of 2008 and 2012 could
right.
win him the election.
That's right.
You're talking states like North Carolina,
yep.
Virginia,
yep.
Michigan,
yep.
Indiana, these Rust Belt states, industrial
yep.
Midwestern states.
Yep.
If Trump starts taking those states, we could be talking President Trump.
That's right. Okay, Eric, thank you, man. This was a very interesting chat, and as always. And we appreciate your time and your enlightening conversation as always.
Wow, that was a very formal goodbye, and thank you.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
I'll catch you later. Thanks a lot. You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.